Hi, this is Drew, and thanks for listening to our podcast. Hopefully you've been enjoying our show for a while now, but if you're a brand new listener, then the next 50 seconds are not for you, so just go ahead and fast forward a bit. I just wanted to ask our longtime listeners to consider becoming patrons of The Drew Marshall Show, because by throwing us just a few bucks each month, you'll be helping what many tell us is the most brutally authentic spiritual show they've ever heard stay on the air. Look, as loyal podcast listeners, you've been getting the same programming our radio listeners have been hearing live Saturdays 1 to 5 for the last 16 years. Except you get to hear everything commercial-free, you smart consumer, you. Well, because of a brand new arrangement with our studio, our expenses have now gone through the roof. And to be brutally honest, we could use the help to cover those costs. So just before you go to bed tonight, maybe you could stop by our website and click on the giant click here to become a patron sign. And if a whole bunch of you were able to scrounge up like $4 per month, then individually your $4 would have just made a massive difference in helping us cover what it costs to bring you the Drew Marshall Show. Okay, that's it. Sorry to bug you. Now on with the show. I hope you have a good sleep tonight after you become a patron.
But I always thought that I'd see you again.
All right, we're back. Thanks for tuning in. You are listening to The Drew Marshall Show. Years ago, I remember thinking, how come the only people we hear on the stage at church when they come up and have story time? No, what was it called again? Not story time. What was it called?
Sharing time. No, testimony.
Testimony, that's it.
There we go.
They were always like, oh, I used to struggle with this, or I used to have that, and then God...
I was an axe murderer.
God was amazing, and now I'm amazing, and everything's amazing, and then let's have an offering. There was a little bit of manipulation there sometimes.
A little bit, maybe.
But I always wondered, well, how come people don't ever get up there and go, you know what, I'm still struggling, or I'm still not sure, or where is God, or I've got this disease and I haven't been healed, that kind of stuff.
Yep.
So we sort of turned that into a thing called the Journey segment here on the Drew Marshall Show, and joining us today from, I think, Edmonton is Julie Rohr. Julie, you are in Edmonton, a true story?
I am. Yes, I am in Edmonton, true story.
The only thing I know about Edmonton... Wait, I know two things about Edmonton. No, three things. This is not going to be exciting. First of all, West Edmonton Mall, everyone goes, ooh, that's where that is. And then secondly, Birch Bay Ranch, I think was a Christian camp I helped out at it for a few days while I was driving around North America for 6 months volunteering at camps.
Nice.
And then...
The Oilers.
I don't care about the Oilers. There was a radio station that offered me, they said, do you want to work with us? And I thought about it, and then I looked at where Edmonton really was in the map, and I said, no.
Right. Well, that's a sane decision. However, I mean, I am a big city booster. I love living here. I really couldn't imagine living anywhere else. But I do understand your feeling. We have one of your boys here playing for our team, and, you know, we love him. But, sometimes I wonder if he regrets choosing Edmonton, too. I'm talking about Connor McDavid, of course.
Of course.
Hockey hero.
Yeah. But the problem is that you're about 10 kilometers from the North Pole?
Well, yeah, sometimes it feels like that. Yeah, some days. Today's pretty nice, though. Can't complain.
But how much snow is outside in the front lawn there?
I mean, not a lot right now. Probably like
a foot.
Foot. Yeah, around a foot. Maybe.
Not much. I love that.
Sure is.
All relative.
Not much. Yeah.
So, Julie, your story came across my plate one day when I was going through some emails, and I saw a story, well, I guess an email thread that came through from, I don't even know how to pronounce her first name. Can you help me pronounce her first name?
Yeah, Vienne King, you're talking about.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and she's a friend of mine here, yeah.
Well, what a lovely woman she is. And I sort of said to you, hey, because I couldn't say her name right. You know the lady with sort of reddish hair who's in a wheelchair? And everybody knew who that was.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. Remember her?
Yeah. Oh, she was awesome.
Dynamic woman.
Yeah, she's lovely, and we connected here when I was speaking at an event, and she was at that event, and she came up to me after and said, we need to be friends, and she was right. We've had some powerful moments together, her and I.
Well, there were numerous people that she interviewed for her website, and you were one of them, so I want to get into your story right now.
Mm-hmm.
So first of all, her website is goingfarther.org. I want to give a plug there where the plug is due, for sure, goingfarther.org. The day you received the diagnosis, take us through that.
Yeah.
What happened?
Well, so it was fall of 2015, I'm a 33-year-old young mom of boys. I was a very busy person. I still am a very busy person. But back then, I just was living at a very fast pace and had been experiencing pain through the summer, ignored it, as I tend to do, because I figure it'll just go away eventually. It did not go away eventually. Long story short, we did a whole bunch of tests, and the pain was not related to the disease I have. But after some ultrasounds and stuff, they ended up finding a tumor, told me I had leiomyosarcoma. And I will never forget that my doctor, when she came in with a piece of paper in her hand and was reading it to me, was crying. And I was thinking, well, this cannot be good if my doctor's crying. And she basically said, we don't know much about this. I'm so sorry to have to give you this diagnosis. Do you want to be alone to process this right now? And I said, yes, please. And she gave me a few minutes for me to compose myself. And that was the day I found out I had cancer.
Wow. So who was there with you?
I went on my own. I'm pretty intentional about going to some appointments on my own, because for me, the process of seeing my loved ones receive bad news about me is harder than just doing it myself some days. So I had gone to that appointment by myself at my own choice, because I had lots of people offer to go with me. I have a big family here. I have lots of supportive friends, but that day I was alone.
What I need to know from you is, you know, as soon as you hear the C word, the cancer, you know, all that kind of stuff, do you go, like, what happens spiritually to you? What happens with the denominational baggage that you've grown up with? What's your spiritual, I guess, knee-jerk reaction? Do you go into parachute prayer? You know, we don't really throw up our prayers until we've jumped out of the plane, kind of thing. Or did you go into panic prayer? Like, what happens?
Yeah. So I a little context is that I grew up the daughter of a Pentecostal pastor. So religion was the key foundation of my life. I mean, I, from the age of birth until like 20 years old, was in church 4 times a week doing every program. I led the programs. I was a worship leader. I was a youth leader. I did all those things. That was my life. And I went through a crisis of faith prior to this diagnosis. But coming back to this diagnosis, my reaction on that day and within the next kind of 2 weeks was simply complete panic. I was completely shocked. I didn't know even what to pray. I didn't know how to pray. I didn't even know how to attempt to pray in those 2 weeks. I was just kind of crying out to God in a guttural way that I had never done before. And so once I kind of got over the shock of the reaction, though, the shock of the diagnosis, I could kind of see things a little more clearly with a more rational head, and then kind of came back into myself at that point.
How old are you now?
So I'm 36. It's been 3 years since my diagnosis. That's my age.
Should you be alive?
Well, that's a good question. I was told upon diagnosis I would be lucky to live 5 years. I'm 3 years in, and I'm doing much better than I expected. I mean, they told me upon diagnosis that it was incurable, and there are lots of people who die very quickly from this disease. I mean, I'm part of an online Facebook group about leiomyosarcoma, and there's really not an average lifespan. It's really hard to find an average, because some people have been alive for 20 years with this disease, and some people die within 6 months. It's very aggressive. It's very unpredictable. There is no way to tell what it's going to do in my body. So should I be alive? That's a good question.
Yeah, but so I don't know. Maybe I'm getting too horror movie on this, but when you know, I got 6 different directions on this in my brain. Some women, when they have a child growing inside of them, freak out because it feels like there's something alien growing inside of them, right? So they're and they're just pregnant. This is supposed to be a beautiful thing, blah, blah, blah. But they still freak out. Now, you've got this disease that's, you know, inside of you. And I don't know if growing is the right term, but it's inside of you.
Yes.
Do you ever totally freak out knowing that something is inside of you that's going to kill you?
Yeah, that's a good question. I was told right at the beginning it was about the size. The tumor they found then was about the size of a mandarin orange, or just a little bigger than a mandarin orange. At the time, actually, my husband and I were really hoping to have another baby. We're a blended family, and he has a son, and I have a son. We came into this relationship and then hoping to, you know, create our own child. And so to find out I had a tumor growing in my abdomen was, it was shocking on so many levels, because I wanted it to be a baby. Do you know what I mean? I wanted to have a baby, but it was a tumor. And a lot of my friends were having babies at the time, and it was just a reminder that the thing inside me is not what, it's not the thing inside you. And I was struggling with feelings of, you know, resentment and, God, why is this happening to me? Like, I don't want this to be happening. I don't want this to be growing in me. And yeah, sometimes the feeling that there's something alien in me is a very strange feeling, but at the same time, it's all my own self. So I kind of think of it as my own cells just sort of, they've taken a wrong turn. They've gotten a little confused. And I prefer to look at it that way than some alien being inside me, because it's less scary to think of it as my own cells, which I can convince to come back to health maybe one day.
Interesting. Tim, my engineer here is looking at me going, I want in on this conversation. What's going on?
Well, I don't know if this is going to be hard for you to talk about it, but the type of cancer, is it where it is, or is it the type of cancer that sort of defines its aggressiveness?
You think you were a son of a doctor or something with that
almost,
kind of question.
But I couldn't pronounce the name, so I wasn't going to go there.
It's a tricky one. But so sarcoma is a cancer of the soft muscle tissue, and can appear basically anywhere in your body. And no matter where it is in your body, it's incurable and aggressive. So there are people who have it, most women who have it, actually, it's like in the uterus. Mine was in my retroperitoneal, so abdomen area, but it did spread to my liver, my lungs. Now it's in my spine. So certainly wherever it is in your body, wherever it's first discovered, your prognosis isn't necessarily better or worse given where they found it. It's really how early they find it and what treatment you take immediately upon finding it. So generally surgery is the gold standard for this cancer. I was very lucky to have three amazing surgeons that did a great job on me in the past. And so that's why I'm still here 3 years later. Not everybody's so lucky. I live in a city with a big cancer center that is really renowned in Canada for how top-notch it is. You know, if I lived in a smaller center or didn't have access to this kind of care, I don't know what I'd do.
Julie Rohr joining us from Edmonton. Julie, I remember a friend of mine, I remember his wife had cancer, and he did not allow people, or he would challenge people, I guess, around him to only use positive verbiage. In other words, couldn't say something like, so how long do you have? Or are you prepared for the end? You know, that kind of stuff. It would always be, well, the Lord is going to, and I don't know, that kind of positive stuff. I can't even think of other examples, but, you know, healing is going to happen. And the reason it's going to happen is because we're saying it's going to happen. We're naming it and claiming it.
Well, that is a very interesting one.
Yeah. So listen, little miss, son of a Pentecostal preacher, what do you deal with that? Or how do you deal with that? Do you, have you done that, by the way? Because here's, this is like the longest question in the world now. Because when you are faced with a potential death sentence, you try everything. You drink carrot juice, you soak your feet in oregano oil. I don't know. You do ear candling, right?
True.
You do everything.
I have done the strangest things. I have drank tea made of crazy mushrooms cut off birch trees. And I have had drinks that taste like they came out of a lawnmower. And I've had every tea, and I've tried every therapy. I do believe in trying everything, for sure. But when it comes to name it and claim it and positive thinking, this is an interesting topic for me, because there are a lot of different ways of approaching a disease. And there's a school of thought that if you say, I'm dying, then you are dying. But if you say, I will live, I'm going to be healed, then you will be healed. Like, there's definitely that train of thought. And I kind of was raised, my parents, I mean, they're Pentecostal. They weren't really name it and claim it people, but they were very much like, your words have power people.
Right.
So you know, well, I wouldn't believe that if I said I have cancer, I'm dying, that would increase my rate of death or increase the speed of at which I would die. I do believe that my words have power, and I do believe that, you know, positive and hopeful thinking and attitude can help even with the symptoms of my disease. So I am staunchly not a name it and claim it person. I have been to a lot of healing services because my train of thought is, if God is present in a place where Christians are gathered, God can work however God wants to work, whether it's through these, you know, evangelical touring faith healers, or whether it's in a room with three other Christians who are praying a simple prayer of faith. God can work in either of those scenarios or choose not to. And so I don't limit my experience just because I dislike the name it and claim it theology.
Whoa.
Does that make any sense? Does that make sense?
Totally makes sense.
Try it anyways.
I don't like it, but it makes sense. Because
yeah.
No, because I have a major problem with the name and claim it and the blab it and grab it group.
Yeah.
I think it's harmful, actually.
It can be. It can be very harmful, and I have seen people harmed by that theology. So I approach it with, you know, a little fear and trembling, a little skepticism. I approach it with the perspective that, God, you know, I have seen you. I have seen people healed. I have seen that with my own eyes because of the way that I grew up and the amount of services I was a part of. But I have seen many, many more people actually hurt by that theology. So I approach it very cautiously and say, God, you know, if you want to work in this moment, in this setting, I'm here. And if, you know, if that doesn't look how I think it should look, then that's fine. I'm very open to God moving how God will move.
Julie, what does being ready to die look like?
That's a question. I was raised also being around seniors a lot. My dad worked in a seniors home for a time, and so as a young teen, probably between the ages of 12 and 14, we were volunteering at a seniors home a lot. And so there was a board on the wall that would have the pictures and names of the people that died that month. So death to me was very regular. It was very normalized in those years. A few years back, my grandfather was dying of melanoma, and I moved out of my house and moved into his house for the 10 days before he died. I moved in with my little boy, who was 4 at the time. And I remember one night I asked him, I said, are you afraid? Like, what does it feel like? What does it feel like to know you're dying? And he looked at me and he said, afraid? He said, afraid of what? And I said, well, you know, like the process, like the pain, like, I don't know. Seeing the light at the end of the tunnel, does that bring fear to you? And he smiled at me with this peaceful smile. And he said, I have nothing to be afraid of because I know where I'm going. And to me, although I am a much more, like a much more liberal thinker than my grandfather was, that never left me. That peace that he had upon his dying days stayed with me. And when I received my own diagnosis, I thought to myself, whatever that was that he did to achieve that peace on his deathbed, I want that peace on my deathbed. Like, I want to know how to die without being afraid of it. So to that end, being ready to die for me is that I am very intentional with my life right now. And so I'm intentional in healing relationships that are broken or working hard to make sure my kids are also prepared for my death, and working hard to make sure that people around me will remember the things that I lived for, if that makes any sense.
How do you prepare your kids for your death? Like, that just seems like that seems impossible.
Yeah. We have different ways of going about it here at our house. Our oldest, who is now 12, knows a lot more about what's going on because he's able to process that information a little bit better. He also has his mom. I am his stepmom. So he has both his mom and his dad. And while, of course, it would affect him greatly when I die, it's not like he will be left without a mom. So it's our youngest that has the most anxiety. And so we talk with him really gently when he asks me, you know, Mom, how do I know when you're going to die? What if you die tomorrow? What if you, you know, he comes to me with these fears and concerns. Sure. And it's usually at night when we're just putting him to bed kind of thing. I'm cuddling with him in bed. And that's when he'll bring up any kind of fear or anxiety. And I just say to him, you know what? I'm living a life that I'm proud of. So when I die, no matter when that is, I will not have regrets. And that's how I want you to live. Like, none of us actually has any guarantee of life. That's what I'm impressing upon him, because I don't want him to live in anxiety that around any corner he could get hit by a bus. But at the same time, the reality that life is fragile is something that I think everybody should be living every day with.
Yeah, especially North America, because we don't live with that thinking.
We don't, and other cultures really do that a lot better than we do.
They sure do. They sure do. Julie Rohr is online with us. She's from Edmonton. Are you from Edmonton?
I am, yeah. Born in Edmonton. Kind of moved around Canada a bit in my younger years, but have lived here for a long time.
Dude, you are not 36. You, like, the wisdom leaking out of your face right now is ridiculous. The wisdom leaking out of your face. I could probably say that better.
A diagnosis kind of instantly changes.
Grows you up a little bit?
Yep, it instantly ages you, yeah. Yes.
Wow. You know, instantly I went to, my goodness, how do you tell your kids and the coping mechanisms of the kids and how are the kids processing? But you've got a husband, too, and I don't know what my question is in this one. I guess it's assumed that the husband will be supportive and encouraging and amazing, but I've heard many stories that aren't like that, and the husbands are useless and irritating and abrasive, and it's because they're coping with this too, and they don't know actually how to process this journey alongside of you. You know, we barely know how to treat women anyway, but when this curveball gets thrown, like, what do we do? So how are things with your husband?
Yeah, that's a good question. And caregiver support and caregiver burnout rates are huge with a diagnosis like this.
Yeah.
With a diagnosis that says you're probably going to be sick for a while and then die from it, that's not a positive diagnosis and can be a huge, is obviously a huge life changer for the spouse and the caregiver. My husband, I'm really one of the lucky ones. I know a lot of women who went through trauma and divorce and separation, like through their diagnosis experience. Mine is not like that. My husband doubled down on his love and adoration for me and his desire to really show me that even if these are our last years together, they're going to be our best years. And he's been amazing. He's definitely had to draw his own boundaries in terms of work and other outside activities so that he can remain sane. Because there are times when I am incapable of doing a lot of things around the house and he is ending up doing a lot of the work. And, you know, I worry about like resentment and burnout and is he going to get tired of doing all these things that I can no longer do? But I know that's a nonsense thought because the depth of our relationship, I'm an ENFP. I'm a big personality person. So I know what my personality is. I'm like the Enneagram and all that stuff. I'm really into all of that. And so when I met him and learned about his personality, and we recognized even from reading about our personalities that we're such a good match for one another and very balanced. So we're just very lucky to have one another. Wow. But certainly not everybody is in that same boat. And I recognize that. And I tread very carefully on that topic when I'm talking with other people who are living with disease, because certainly not everyone gets what I have.
Julie, do you ever come out to Ontario?
Once in a while, yeah.
You should be more excited about that question. Do you ever come out to Ontario?
I was in Toronto earlier this year to meet with some sarcoma specialists to talk to them about their trials that they have there. That was the last time I was out.
Okay.
But yeah, I used to live in Nepean when I was a kid.
Okay, well, I'm just saying that next time you come back, will you please let me know? I'd love to have you in studio and to have a follow-up interview with you, because there's so, like, your journey intrigues me intensely. I mean, we haven't even gotten to the whole, well, my dad's a Pentecostal. Is your dad still alive?
He is, and he is still a preacher. He has changed his Well, I shouldn't say changed his views. He's definitely, throughout his life, has been different types of pastor.
Yeah.
And now he's very much in a state of kind of gentle pastoring. It's very gentle. It's not like forceful, in-your-face, evangelical presentation pastoring.
Yeah. But I wonder how much, I wonder what, let's see. You know, if it was me and I was a Pentecostal preacher and I believe in the name and claim it or whatever, just any kind of Pentecostalisms you want to put in there. I'm not saying all Pentecostals believe in name and claim it. Don't get me wrong there. But anyway, if I was a Pentecostal preacher and my child had cancer, terminal cancer, I would be tempted to revert, even if I'd walked away from it, or I would be tempted to get back into, where's the recipe? Where's the formula? What do I need to do again to make sure my daughter survives? Right? We're just desperate people when it comes to this stuff.
Yeah, and my dad, I mean, my dad was the first person I called from the doctor's office. My dad and I have a really special relationship.
Beautiful.
And also, right now, I mean, our views aren't the same on everything, but I think that actually strengthens our relationship. And when I was early in the diagnosis stage, my dad kind of, when I called him from the doctor's office, he said, you know, God's will be done. And if that means I lose you, I mean, if God's plan is bigger than me and bigger than I can understand, and if that means I lose you, I guess that's what it means. He said, like, I'm hoping and praying that you'll be healed. But my dad is very realistic, and he understands the nature of the disease, and he's not a very hyped up kind of person. He doesn't like the hype and around all of that. So he was very raw with me and honest about his fears and about his hopes. So we've journeyed together through this in a lot of ways, and it's very easy to walk away from faith. I mean, there are days when I'm like, God, heal me already. Like, you can. And so why haven't you? Yeah. And that's a big question, right? I mean, it's been asked since the beginning of time. If God can heal, why doesn't God heal in certain cases? And as I ask this, I'm like, God, you know, the other day I was praying this, God, why haven't you healed me? And just this answer came to my spirit. It was, well, I have healed you. You are healed. Your heart is whole. Your relationships are full. You are living the best life you've ever lived. And actually, that is true. Aside from my cancer, my life is just, I'm living with so much more purpose now than I ever was before. And so if that's what healing actually is, if it's the healing of my spirit, then I will take that. And if my physical body has to struggle in order for me to find my purpose in life and the reason I'm here, I mean, so be it.
Oh, man. Can we please do a follow-up interview with you in the future?
Certainly, certainly.
There's so much more to talk about. And I just, I mean, you know, I just don't want to do the, hey, okay, so you got cancer, tell me about it, and then goodbye. Love to have you back on the show.
There's a lot more to say about it.
Yeah, there really is. There really is. Julie Rohr. Julie, is there a website people can go to, I don't know, track you or follow your journey or anything? You know, everyone's got a website.
I do, yeah. It's at fightamonster.com.
Fightamonster.com?
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's kind of it's a longer story, but the name of the site comes from a fundraiser my son and I did five years ago now for a little girl who had leukemia. And so That was the name of our campaign then, and then we revived it. So anyway, that's where my side is.
So good. So good. Julie, what a pleasure to chat with you. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Drew. It was awesome to chat with you.
We'll speak again, I hope. Take care.
Okay.
Yeah.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Julie Rohr on the Drew Marshall Show, fightamonster.com.